Possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we will be spending some time exploring the life and exploits of certainly one of the most enduring characters in all of Western literature. The man we're talking about here this morning is Sherlock Holmes. Since the very first Holmes adventure appeared in print in 1891, these stories have never been out of print. They have been translated into virtually every language, and every year many books and magazines about Sherlock Holmes are published. In addition, Sherlock Holmes is said to be the single most filmed character ever. Over 200 movies have been made about Sherlock Holmes. This morning, we'll talk a little bit about Holmes and his great popularity with Leslie Klinger, who's considered to be one of the world's leading authorities on Sherlock Holmes. He's the editor of a newly published two-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. It's been published, it came out last month, published by W.W. Norton, and this is a collection of the 56 short stories, along with a good deal of commentary on the stories and the characters and elements of daily life in the Victorian era. Certainly, you can read these stories without knowing those things, but I myself was reminded going back and reading the stories just how many details there are that might be unintelligible to people who didn't live during the Victorian times. Having a book like this, if you're a dedicated Sherlock fan, can help you appreciate the stories even more. So for someone who is interested in mystery writing, or particularly in Holmes, it might make a nice gift. It's just out. Two very large, heavy volumes published, printed on very good paper. The kind of thing that you could hold on to for a long time. They have just come out. And then there also is planned another sort of companion volume that would contain the novels, the four novels that Conan Doyle wrote. And that is due to be published in November of next year, 2005. Just a little bit more about our guest, Leslie Klinger. He was born in Chicago and went to school out in California. He's a graduate of University of California, Berkeley. He got his law degree there. He's a graduate of Bolt Hall. And since graduating from law school, he has lived in Los Angeles, pursuing a legal career in tax, estate, and business planning, but also has continued to be a dedicated fan, enthusiast when it comes to Holmes. He's a member of the Baker Street Irregulars and also serves as series editor for the manuscript series of the Baker Street Irregulars. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Klinger, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
We certainly do appreciate it. Let me also just mention to people that, two things. One is that Leslie Klinger will be in Chicago later this month. He'll be giving a talk at the Newberry Library in Chicago. This will be on December 18th, 11 o'clock in the morning, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. And then, of course, if there's anyone who is listening this morning who would like to call in, you are welcome to do that, too, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I guess I would begin by asking the question I know you've been asked over and over and over again in interviews by various kinds of people, and that is, how do you account for the great and continuing popularity of this character?
I think it's really a combination of factors. First, these are great stories. The author was a great storyteller. They're very pleasurable to read over and over again. We don't read these stories, I think, anymore for the mysteries. To our somewhat jaded 21st century eye, these stories seem very cliched. We have to keep in focus, of course, that this was the invention of many of these cliches. Mm-hmm. But they are pleasurable to read and re-experience. I think the characters draw us to them again and again. Sherlock Holmes, in many ways, somebody that we greatly admire, always in command, seems to know everything, and yet he does the right thing in circumstances. He doesn't just follow the law. He's not some police detective, you know, trying to get the crook. He often will forgive the villain or decide what he thinks is the right thing to do. And then he's paired with Dr. Watson, an intelligent, loyal, dependable companion. I think some of us feel like we'd like to be Dr. Watson. You get to hang around with Sherlock Holmes, and yet you get to go home at night. I don't think Holmes was always the most pleasant person to be with.
I think in that respect, I have always felt that Dr. Watson never really got the respect that was due to him. Because if we take the conceit that these were real people, you have to admit that Sherlock Holmes would have been an almost impossible person to live with. The man had no friends. Watson was his one friend in the world, and he was always there for him. And this would not have been easy. It would not have been an easy man to live with. And I've always felt that Watson really we really need to raise a glass to Watson if we're going to do that for anyone.
The long suffering Dr. Watson.
Exactly.
And of course, it's through Watson's eyes that we see Holmes. 57 of the stories are written by Watson, and it's his voice we hear. It's his eyes that we see these things through. And I think that adds a special element to the story. When we look at the people who copied Holmes over the years, and I mean virtually every mystery writer of the 20th century, the great invention of these stories was the presence of Dr. Watson. It lets the reader partake of the story in a way that you don't when you read Poe's Dupin, a cold, rational detective and a narrator that is forgettable.
We have a couple of callers. Why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation rather than make them wait? We'll start out with someone listening this morning in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. And one question you already answered. This sort of question is coming from my early teens. The Baker Street Irregulars, I guess, are still in existence. So
yes, founded in 1934. This is our 70th anniversary. It's changed over the years. It started out as really almost a drinking group. It was Christopher Morley and a group of his friends who they like to get together and have a lot of cocktails and talk about their favorite literary characters. It evolved into a more organized organization. There are now about 300 members around the world. And it's not an organization where you sort of send in your dues and fill out an application, send in your dues. You get invited to join. And it's an organization dedicated to preserving the memory of the master.
Yeah, now, when I first started reading Sherlock Holmes, I had that, unfortunately I don't remember, but it was one huge hardback, and if I remember correctly, had India paper, that real thin paper.
Did it have footnotes?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think so.
Well, you probably had the Doubleday edition, which is still in print, the complete Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
A wonderful introduction by Christopher Morley. It came out in the 1930s, and it's still in print.
Yeah. Okay, well, next question I have, which I'm interested in, is I've got most of the, English-speaking films, I remember one in particular I've always liked, The Triumph of Sherlock Holmes, as Arthur Wattner.
Yes.
And Ian Fleming. Then, unfortunately, I can't find, or maybe I haven't just searched enough, but there's a series I liked, though it was in some ways pathetic, but it was Ronald Howard's.
Yeah, that's now out on DVD.
It's
39 episodes. It was a television series.
Yeah. Yeah.
It came out in the early 1950s.
Yeah.
They're kind of fun. It was done on very low budget. And
for sure. What was interesting, it was an English group done in France, I think. And
yes.
In fact, one of the ladies that showed up on it turned out to be the wife of the wealthy man on Gilligan's Island.
Well, they had an extremely low budget to the point where they even would take an actor who appeared in the first 10 minutes of an episode and use him again in the end of the episode to fill a different part.
Yeah, I remember that. I'm just laughing because I was showing it to a person that I thought, you know, should be, you know, taught that about Sherlock Holmes, and he mentioned, my God, that looks like somebody in the beginning of that
now,
half hour.
Now, here's a trivia answer for you about that series. That series is the only filmed depiction of the meeting of Holmes and Watson. One of the episodes is called The Cunningham Heritage, and it shows Watson meeting Holmes in the laboratory at Bart's. It's never been done in any other film.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a footnote question to that is, you might be able to help me. When I've taped all these off small TV station here in Indiana that's now defunct, but a lot of times if they didn't have any time, they just cut off the beginnings where it would give the title. And I remember there's one that shows up where a man, rather harsh fellow, that's in a bar, and I think he returns to his table, and it's either a chicken's foot or something like that is there. And I've never been able to find out what the title of that particular episode was.
I can't say I remember. There are a number of books that have been published about Sherlock Holmes on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most complete is one by Gordon Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, called something like the Sherlock Holmes Screen and Film Guide.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up, you can search for it, that book on the Internet, and it'll give you summaries of every episode.
Okay. And the last question, well, since there's other people, I'm sure, is who's the best of the actors? You go with Jeremy Brett, or do you go with somebody else?
My personal preference is Jeremy Brett, but it's... Yeah. I also want to add that it's not just Brett. Brett was, I thought, wonderful in the part. I thought he really captured the bohemian, kind of over-the-top nature of Holmes.
Yeah.
But that series also had two other major positive things going for it. One was the two actors who played Dr. Watson, David Burke and Edward Hardwick. They caught the right flavor. They played Watson, as we were discussing earlier, as an intelligent, dependable, loyal kind of person that Holmes would want to hang around with. Further, those scripts followed the stories closely.
Yeah, and that's what I liked about.
So that combination makes that series tremendously appealing to me.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. I would second that. I really enjoyed the series very much myself and thought that Jeremy Brett really was wonderful. And although I would guess probably each age maybe would have its favorite, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would like to give their vote to Basil Rathbone, and then if we could go back to those people who could see those actors that became well known playing Holmes on the stage,
sure,
you know they might say that was it William Gillette,
right? And of course William Gillette really became the image of Holmes in the Frederick Dorr Steele illustrations mm-hmm. that appeared in the American magazines. Steele used him as the model, and by all accounts he was a wonderful Holmes. The Basil Rathbone characterization is fabulous. I just think Rathbone is perfect for the part, but with 12 horrible scripts, I say horrible, they're not true at all to the idea of Sherlock Holmes in the Victorian age. There was only so far he could go with the part.
Yeah, and I was in as sweet a man as I'm sure Nigel Bruce was. I guess I'm have real mixed feelings about his portrayal of Dr.
Yes.
Watson. Well, let's go to another caller here. We'll go to line one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. Fascinating topic. I wonder if you could spend some time talking about the other five novels of Arthur Conan Doyle. I had never even heard of them.
Well, you mean his non-Sherlock Holmes books?
Right. You said that you were coming out with a...
No, well, actually, let me be clear. What's coming out next year are the four Sherlock Holmes novels, A Study in Scarlet, The Sign of Four, The Hound of the Baskervilles, and The Valley of Fear. For reasons of size, more than anything else, we just decided that we would limit the first two volumes, which are almost 1,900 pages, to the short stories. The third volume will be another 900 to 1,000 pages.
Wow.
So we didn't want anybody hurting themselves carrying these books around.
So would you mention, please, those names again? The Hound of the Baskerville,
yes,
of course, I know.
The first one was A Study in Scarlet. That was the very first appearance of Sherlock Holmes. It came out in 1887. The next was a novel called The Sign of Four. That came out shortly after that, 1889. And those two predate any of the short stories. The short stories began appearing in 1891. They ran for 2 years. Then there was a hiatus. In 1901, it began the serialization of the novel called The Hound of the Baskervilles. And then finally in 1915, a fourth, and we say novel, they're really very long stories, called The Valley of Fear was published.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And I guess maybe we should mention that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote, quote-unquote, these stories, wrote hundreds of stories and wrote a number of other novels. And in fact, he considered a lot of his other writing to be more important and perhaps at points was maybe a little irritated that Sherlock Holmes was so popular and that was what he really, in a lot of people's minds, that's what he was known for.
Yes, I love Doyle's little anecdote in which he said that his feelings after having sort of put aside the Sherlock Holmes stories in 1893 was the same feeling he'd experienced when he'd eaten too much foie gras.
As you note, there was a point where Doyle became, he was just tired of it, and he decided to kill the character. And that's where we had that story where Holmes and his great nemesis, Dr. Moriarty, struggle at the Reichenbach Falls. Is it called The Final Solution?
The Final Problem.
The Final Problem is that story. And there was in England, there was a huge outcry.
Yes.
People were very, very upset. And then sometime later, Doyle decided that he would bring the character back and wrote then a number of other stories.
Right. Well, and I think the story of the return of Holmes is interesting. In 1901, Doyle had the idea for what he called a real thriller. It was going to be a book about a sort of a ghost dog, a mysterious murder, and if this sounds familiar to anybody, of course it turned into The Hound of the Baskervilles. But when he first conceived of the story, it did not include Sherlock Holmes. He was offered basically to get double pay by his publisher if he would make it a Sherlock Holmes story. I think Doyle considered it and decided that artistically it worked well and added Holmes to the mix. 1903, an American publisher, Collier's Magazine, came to Doyle with an extraordinary offer, basically said, we would like you to write more stories, name your price. I think trying to get rid of them, Doyle named an exorbitant sum, and Collier said, we'll take it, we'd like 10. So he began to write stories again, and I think he discovered that notwithstanding that he felt he had put the nails firmly into Holmes's coffin, that maybe he'd left himself, consciously or unconsciously, an opening because he was very able to get Holmes out of that chasm at the Reichenbach Falls and back onto the pages of the Strand Magazine. Hmm.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Leslie Klinger. He is the editor of a recently published two-volume set of the short stories, the Sherlock Holmes short stories, 56. It's titled The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. It's published by W.W. Norton in a large, nicely printed hardcover version that contains all these stories and a series of notes about details in the stories, about the stories themselves and how they were published, about the characters, and explaining some of the various details about Victorian era life that might elude you if you weren't schooled in that. There also, as he has mentioned, there will be another volume published in November of 2005 that will contain the four novels, the Sherlock Holmes novels that Conan Doyle wrote. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller now awaiting in Pena, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Back during the 1930s and 40s, I used to listen to Sherlock Holmes very loyally with my Irish immigrant grandmother and grandpa. And that got me to thinking, I wondered if Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was Irish. I know that Doyle can be Irish. That's my question. Thank you.
Conan Doyle, born and raised in Scotland. There certainly are substantial Irish connections in the family. I don't have the entire family tree at my fingertips, but absolutely there are Irish connections.
All right. Oh, by the way, for the benefit of the caller who from Indiana, the man who called first, our meteorologist Mike Sola was listening in, and he came in and handed me a note, and the fact that he is giving me the information, I'm sure it's right, who says that he's familiar with the thing that the caller was talking about, this Holmes story where there's a chicken foot on the table, and he says that the name of that particular story is The Case of the Blind Man's Bluff.
Sounds right to me.
All right. Well, if Mike says it, I'm sure it's right. Urbana next, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Every now and then when I'm seeing another fictional detective, I think Holmes might have inspired some of the aspects of this particular detective. And this one's on television, and it's the Gil Grissom character on CSI Crime Scene Investigators. The guy has no personal life. He's totally devoted to his job. He's totally scientific. Of course, he's not an independent detective. He's part of a municipal crime lab. But I think there's a lot of Holmes in that character. I don't know if you have ever observed this TV show, but I'd be interested in what you think.
I have not, but I've read the same observation from other critics. And I'm sure you're right. Not only did the writers get the idea of the character of the detective from it, but I think we also have to understand the important role that Holmes played in the entire development of forensic science. Back at the time when the stories of Holmes's career were appearing, the police did not use fingerprints as means of identification. The police did not pay serious attention to the details of the crime scene. Holmes was the leader in such things as taking plaster casts of footprints and combing the scene of the crime for clues. Those were new ideas. And I think the CSI Baker Street is a series I'd like to see.
That sounds great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think you cannot sell short the influence of the character of Holmes on so many detectives who came after, not just in, as you said earlier, the fact that now almost every detective has to have a sidekick and amanuensis that helps, so many of the aspects of his character and the way that he goes about doing it have been either outright stolen or at the very least, you see that those shadows of his character and the character of an awful lot of other detectives. Even though he was not the first, this was not the first detective in literature, he seems to be the archetypal detective in
literature.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And of course, it was the first great successful detective. We have to remember the enormous commercial success that these stories achieved. And Doyle quickly became one of the two highest paid writers in England, the other being Rudyard Kipling. And a lot of writers said, gee, I can jump on that bandwagon and write a detective that's got a strange set of personal habits and an interesting companion, and I can make some of that.
One of the things that I wondered about and would like you to talk a little bit about, we have discussed the fact that when these stories were published, they were hugely popular, and that they are still very, very popular. As I said at the beginning, they've never been out of print. I wonder, as you think about what it is that the Victorian audience would have gotten and how they would have thought about the character, and then compare that with what a contemporary audience, and is that the same thing, or do we read these differently now than people read them at the turn of the century?
I think we do read them differently. The science that's on display in the stories, the whole rational approach to crime, we take for granted. For the Victorian audience, I think that was a great revelation, that there was something that could be done to detect the committer of crimes. The characters, I think, had the same appeal then that they do today, but of course the Victorians didn't need all these footnotes to explain the Victorian age to them. But I think they also did see the stories as very rich and complex pictures of their own age. They would have recognized immediately the war veterans that show up in these stories, the cultural references, etc. But nonetheless, the stories appealed because of the idea that rationalism could overcome the dark side of life, I think. And of course, that was a very much a Victorian ideal. There was also a specific element to this series of stories that was unique, and that is a continuing character. Certainly, the Victorian audience was very tuned in to short stories. This was an age, of course, no radio, no television. The stage was available, but it was a limited audience. And newspapers and magazines were the great mass media of the day. There were other publishers trying short story magazines. There were certainly numbers of them out there. The Strand magazine had two good things going for it. One was a picture every other page. That was a new idea copied from American magazines. And the second was that with Conan Doyle, they published a series of stories about the same character. This made it very appealing for readers to subscribe to the magazine so they could read more about that great character.
Let's talk with another caller in Rantoul, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've just got two questions that you may be able to answer. One of them is, at one time, I believe Rex Stout and a bunch of other mystery writers were sitting around debating something about Holmes, and it came to a point where they were wondering if he was homosexual or not or something like that.
Not quite. Here's what you're recalling.
Yes.
Rex Stout, who the facilitator of the publication of the stories about Nero Wolfe, because there are those who claim that Wolfe himself was a real person.
Of course. We'll
talk about that in a second. But in any event, he wrote an article. He gave a talk, which he turned into a famous article called Watson Was a Woman.
Yes.
And this was a matter of great debate, and, of course, the fundamentalists thought that this was nonsense, but Stout made a at least plausible case for this argument. Now, there's been other books on sort of different aspects of the same question. There is a book that just was reissued called Ms. Holmes of Baker Street, The Truth About Sherlock, in which the authors contend at great length and with tons of evidence that Holmes was a woman who took up male disguise to pursue the profession that she wanted to, because it was not a time when a woman could have done that outwardly. And Watson eventually knew about it, but they had a pretty chaste relationship, according to this book.
Oh, it's just, again, we rewrite history to amuse ourselves, it seems like.
That's right. I was asked point blank recently in a talk whether I thought Holmes was gay, and my answer was that I didn't think he had the time.
Yeah.
I think that Holmes basically was asexual. He was so busy with his career that he really didn't have time to pay attention or want to pay attention to men, women, or any other proclivity.
Yeah, I always got that feeling as well. And the other thing I was going to mention, we're talking about TV shows and movies. Here's an odd one. It may be in the book or not. I'll need to go ahead and buy this collection for the footnotes. There was an Italian television series for children called Detective Hound that was illustrated by, or at least designed by, Hanno Miyazaki, who's done bunches of stuff that's famous now. And it's just this wonderfully told children's stories. Of course, they don't really hold close to the actual stories and that
right.
sort of stuff.
There. I've heard of the series. I am not familiar with it, and it's not mentioned in the book. I must say, with those who are expecting a lot of material about films and television in the book, there's very little. There's some, but it's very little. There are a number of specialized books dealing with that. I did discuss it briefly in the introduction with some examples and showed some of the great actors. And where relevant, I've mentioned specific films or television shows that I thought shed some light on a particular story. But that's a very minor element in the book.
Well, the thing that's amazing is the reach of this character all these years ago, that you have an Italian children's series based off it, or an American science fiction series based off it.
Well, and we should also mention, just because it's so interesting, I guess, a recent children's series animated called Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd Century.
Right.
In which Holmes has been thawed, I guess. Watson is a robot. And Inspector Lestrade is a woman police officer.
I guess he's just one of those archetypes that we can't get away with. Get away from.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Leslie Klinger. He is the editor of the recently published two-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, published by W.W. Norton. And I do also want to mention again that he has been doing some traveling to talk about the book and about Sherlock Holmes, and that he will be in Chicago on December 18th at the Newbery Library, 11 o'clock in the morning. And it's open to anyone who would be interested in attending. Was there lots of crime at the time? I mean, was in Victorian England, was that a daily occurrence? Would the pages of the papers be full of that, and would that be something that would be really uppermost in people's minds?
Sure. And I think we also have to reflect that the whole concept of a police force was new. The police really had been born in the early 19th century with Sir Robert Peel's bobbies, and the Scotland Yard Central Investigative Division was far newer. That really only came about in the 1860s. So there was a tremendous growth of crime with the growth of the cities and with the mobility of the railroads, and Victorians were very mindful of violence in the streets, all kinds of crime, and therefore the idea of a rational detective was very appealing.
There are in the stories, there's not much of biographical information about Holmes before the stories start.
Right.
We know that he has a brother because eventually we meet him, and we know that Holmes went to university. But I'm not sure that past that, there's much in the way of detail about Holmes, and yet the people who love Sherlock Holmes and have spent time poring over the stories, looking for anything that they can use as clues to fill
right.
in that biography.
Well, we know a little bit about his family. We know that he was the son of country squires. We know that his grandmother was French. She was a Vernet, a family of great artists. We know that Holmes went to some university for a couple of years, studying something. He took up lodgings in Montague Street before he moved to Baker Street, where he tried to pursue his career as a detective, or at least was still doing a great deal of studying. He spent time at the British Museum. But you're right, those are pretty sketchy facts. Mm-hmm. And many writers have tried to fill in the blanks, some with their own imaginations, some very interesting. For example, William Baring-Gould, in his biography called Sherlock Holmes at Baker Street, A Life of the World's First Consulting Detective, speculates that Holmes spent some time on the stage as a youth, that he toured America with the Sassenoff Shakespeare Company. No real evidence of that, other than Holmes's constant demonstration of a flair for the dramatic and a real acting ability.
Yeah, and all the many times in the stories he assumes some sort of disguise to go
now, my
underground.
My personal theory is that while he did appear on the stage, it was not as an actor, it was as a magician's assistant. I think that we see a lot of the traits of the stage magician in Holmes, his love of surprise, the dramatic, et cetera. And, of course, that was a very popular form of entertainment in those days.
Mm. And I was really struck whenever I do something like this. Of course, I go out and I like to read reviews of the books. And I was really struck by something that was written in an article about the book that appeared in the Toronto Star, which was someone's take on trying to understand the character of Holmes and what he would be like today. And I'd I kind of liked it, and I'm sort of curious about your reaction. The writer writes this: imagine a very bright 17-year-old who's a whiz at computers or Dungeons and Dragons or ham radio, or who has a huge CD collection of obscure jazz musicians and can analyze their time signatures like a chemist analyzing boron. He never goes out on dates. He hates small talk. He's frightened of emotion. He has no friend except maybe for a sidekick who serves as a sounding board for his brilliant ideas. A clinician might diagnose him as suffering from a mild degree of autism. Imagine that lad then as a Victorian gentleman with an obsessive interest in crime detection. There's your Sherlock Holmes. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's fascinating. The autistic point especially, I'm not sure if the reviewer knew the book called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, in which is about an autistic, I think he's about 13 or 14-year-old boy, who is a great fan of the stories and attempts to emulate Sherlock Holmes. It's a brilliant book about autism. Holmes was pretty dysfunctional, but given the parameter of his time, he made it work. And I like to think that Holmes today would be highly functional. Somebody asked me, did I think he could thrive in the 21st century? And I see him quickly adapting to computers and finding all these new tools for gathering information to be essential to his purpose. But I think that the reviewer also nailed it, that he would still be quite a bit of a recluse. He focused on what was essential and pushed the rest aside. There's a very interesting film, by the way, that makes much the same point, called The Zero Effect, about a modern detective who lives like that. Ben Stiller is his sidekick. It's Bill Pullman playing the detective. It's a lovely film, and about three-quarters of the way through it, you finally realize that it's based on a Sherlock Holmes story.
Huh. I think the other thing that people have speculated about Holmes is that he was chronically suffered from depression. And
bipolar
is the
word I've heard used in this.
Yes, indeed, that because he did seem to alternate between these manic phases, and maybe those were those when he was working, and the times when he was so low that he could hardly get out of bed, and it was the only thing that could get him aroused was the prospect of having a problem
right
to work on.
We should definitely mention his drug use. I'm surprised nobody's asked about it yet, but Holmes did use cocaine in a quote 7% solution. He injected it. And possibly used morphine in the same way. This was, he says, to combat exactly the kind of bipolar swings of moods that he suffered when he had no case to work on. He craved the stimulation of the drug. Now, before we condemn him, I think we ought to remember the context that these drugs were generally available at the local chemist shop, mm-hmm. and their addictive nature was really not understood very well. Cocaine, for example, was widely used in patent medicines and was held out as a tool to relieve fatigue, sharpen the mind, etc. Now, Watson had the good sense to understand that this could be very destructive, and he worked hard to wean Holmes from the drug.
Which he eventually does.
Which he eventually
in the course
probably
of the
does, although Watson says he knows that the demon is only sleeping.
Let's talk with someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering about one of his novels, which was called, I think, The Valley of Fear.
Yes.
In which he took an extremely right-wing and mendacious attitude towards the Molly Maguires.
Well, I think that's really... I know what you mean, but I think that is an unfair charge. Let me put the question in context. The story is a mystery set in contemporary Victorian England, wrapped around the story of an undercover agent employed by the Pinkertons who infiltrates the violent organization called the Molly Maguires in history, known as the Scourers in the story, and essentially overthrows the organization. The Mollies were part of the labor unrest in the anthracite coal regions of Pennsylvania. Now, at the time that the stories were written, the only published accounts were highly condemnatory of the Mollies. And, in fact, of course, there had been mass trial. There were dozens of Molly Maguires that were hanged for violent crimes. And the general public view was that they were pretty bad folks. Now, our 20th century perspective has changed that view. Starting in the 1930s, there was a history of the Mollies written by someone that probably I would call communist, but certainly a far more liberal perspective on the labor movement. And today, most recently, by Professor Kevin Kenney, a wonderful book called Making Sense of the Molly Maguires that puts the Mollies into historical context and suggests that while there may have been violence, it was surely provoked, and it was terrible labor conditions in the mines. And in fact, the Pinkertons themselves may well have been provocateurs in the onset of some of that violence. I think if Doyle had all the facts today, you'd see a much more sympathetic portrait of the Mollies. Although, I have to say, I don't find the novel to be wholly unsympathetic. Certainly, he was well aware of the discrimination against the Irish and the terrible working conditions in the mines. So I guess I'm trying to rise to the defense of the book. We have to remember the context from which it came, and his only real source of information was Alan Pinkerton's very one-sided book called The Molly Maguires and the Detectives.
Well, he presented the Pinkertons as some kind of heroes.
But that was the public view.
Also, one gets the impression, if one doesn't know anything about the American justice system, that the Pinkertons were a legitimate government agency like the FBI.
But again, you have to put it in context. In those days, for example, it was very common for a criminal prosecution to be conducted by the aggrieved party, not the government. It was, in fact, the trials of the Molly Maguires. The chief prosecutor was Franklin McGowan, who was the president of the railroad and owned a number of coal mines. He was a lawyer by training. He was the prosecutor. How hard to believe is that? But that was an accepted practice at the time. Now, subsequent scholars have looked at what went on in the trials of the Mollies and said virtually every due process issue that could have been violated was in those trials. They were travesties of justice. That doesn't mean that there weren't violent crimes committed by certain individuals, probably the Molly Maguires at that time, but they certainly didn't get a fair shake in the trial.
Well, I loved all of Sherlock Holmes. They were my constant diet when I was young, and I swallowed the Molly Maguire story, and then when I found out it was otherwise, I was absolutely appalled, and put a black spot on the name of my hero,
well,
Conan Doyle. Not
I urge you to
Sherlock
wait
Holmes,
a year.
Not Sherlock Holmes, you understand.
I understand. Why don't you wait 12 months, and when you can get the third volume of this series, which will include the Valley of Fear, you'll see that I've tried to set things right in a number of the notes and explain, I guess, what we now perceive to be closer to the truth about the events that took place at that time and that are reflected in the novel. I think, by the way, it's also, if you put aside whether it's historically accurate, I think the section of the novel that deals with the Molly Maguires is a terrific story.
Oh, it's a great story, yes.
So, just think of it as fiction.
However, this one sounds as if it had been written under the instigation of Ashcroft and Gonzalez. Thank you.
I understand. And of course, it was. Doyle heard a version of the story from William Burns, who was the head of the Pinkerton Agency, and probably also spoke to William Pinkerton, Alan Pinkerton's son. And that's where he got his facts from.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Leslie Klinger, considered to be one of the world's leading authorities on Sherlock Holmes, has been studying Holmes and the stories about him for something like 36 years. He is the editor of a newly published two-volume collection of the short stories, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, published by W. W. Norton. And in addition to the stories themselves, there are illustrations from the original publications and also a number of footnotes explaining some of the details in the story that have to do with everyday life in Victorian England, the things that would have been perfectly obvious and understandable to readers at the time that they were published at the turn of the century, but now maybe not quite so familiar. And as he mentioned, there will be a third volume in the series that will include the four Sherlock Holmes novels, and that's expected to be published in a year from now, in November of 2005. He is an attorney. He makes his home now in California. He lives in Los Angeles. He was born in Chicago. Our number, if you want to call real quick, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. So among the things that the students of Holmes and his life have deduced one way or another is a birth date. And this, a lot of people are marking this year as the 100, we've had it already, it was in January, but this year as the 150th anniversary of the birth of Sherlock Holmes. How does one come up with the birthday? I think it's January 6th.
Right. Well, the birthday, let's separate out the two. The birth year is arrived at primarily by a reference in the story, His Last Bow, clearly set in 1914, in which Holmes is described as a man of 60. However, just to undercut that very argument, we have to keep in mind that he's in disguise in the story. Nonetheless, most scholars have grabbed onto that as being the likely birth year. The date is even more controversial. January 6th was first announced by Christopher Morley in a column in the Saturday Review, Christopher Morley, the founder of the Baker Street Irregulars. It just happened to be the date of the issue. And he said, well, the astrologers have suggested January, so how about today? And let's celebrate that. It also turned out to be his brother's birthday. Now, other scholars have come up with some evidence. I think this is really a case of finding the evidence after they've decided what they want to prove, something certainly Holmes would have disapproved of. And that evidence is that Holmes quotes twice from the play Twelfth Night by Shakespeare, Twelfth Night being January 6th.
Hmm. You talked about astrologers. So someone decided he must have been a Capricorn.
I guess so.
Based on his personality and that people who are born into that sign are supposed to have. So that's why it ends up being in January.
And there's at least one argument, one article by Father Vic Holly who lays out much more satisfyingly a suggestion that the birthday is in April. The Baker Street Irregulars meet annually in New York City to celebrate the birthday, and there are many of us who devoutly wish that the April date would have been selected rather than the blizzardy date of January 6th.
Well, being a fellow Capricorn, I'm going to stick with January myself.
Okay.
I guess that what this illustrates is the amount of endless simple pleasure that people have derived from reading these stories and thinking about this character in every possible way that you can.
Endless, delicious minutia, as one scholar called it.
Mm. How did this? We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that, first of all, this made Conan Doyle wealthy. That next to Kipling, he was the wealthiest writer in Britain at the time. Also, the fact that Doyle perhaps felt that this overshadowed some of his other writing and was tired of the character at one point, to the point where he killed the character off, and this was extremely unpopular. So he later brought the character back. Overall, how did Conan Doyle feel about this character?
He viewed it as keeping him from his more important pursuits. And we should mention that was really two different things. One, he was a prolific writer, as you mentioned earlier, of short stories and novels. He wrote historical fiction, The White Company, Micah Clark, Rodney Stone, a number of others. And he felt that that was his better work. He wanted to be remembered for those efforts. He also wrote, by the way, and I'm sure many readers will recall, The Lost World and a few other Professor Challenger novels. So he thought that Holmes was his potboiler, commercial, sort of pulp fiction kind of work. But he also had an intense interest in the spiritualist cause. And it's very clear that for the last 20 or 30 years of his life, that was where he really wanted to focus his energy. The Sherlock Holmes stories became, I think, in a sense, fuel for the vehicle that he wanted to drive. When he needed money, when he needed to get back into the public eye, out came a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yeah, it's interesting that his interest in spiritualism ends up making Conan Doyle a literary character.
Yes.
And in so many places, in some places just in passing, but that and that perhaps that might lead some people to think less of him because of it.
Yeah, but I think that we have to remember that the spiritualist movement was very popular and attracted a number of public figures to the cause, many of them very rational people. This was its height was probably right after World War I, when many, many families very much wanted to be in touch with loved ones who they'd lost in the war. And Doyle's interest was one that started when he was a young man. He was searching for something to believe in. And spiritualism held out the prospects of being a, if you will, a religion that required no faith. It said, we promise that we will be able to prove to you the truth of our assertions. Ultimately, it failed to do that, and that's why it's pretty much gone. But that was the prospect.
We're almost out of time, but just Doyle admitted that part of the inspiration for the character of Sherlock Holmes was a man who had been one of his professors in med school, and Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician.
Right.
So that's there. In what ways, though, do you think Sherlock Holmes was, in fact, a reflection of the personality of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
Well, certainly Doyle was a true gentleman. He was a real knight in the medieval sense of the word. And I think that Holmes did reflect a lot of his better impulses to carry out the causes of justice. And in fact, Doyle himself did become involved in a number of crime investigations and trying to help the wheels of justice turn in a fair and even-handed way. So I agree. I think that there is a great deal of reflection of the do-right character of Conan Doyle.
Well, I think there we will have to finish up again with a reminder that if people are interested in Sherlock Holmes or you know someone who is, you might want to look at this book that we mentioned. Our guest, Leslie Klinger, is the editor. It's The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, published by W.W. Norton, and it has just come out. And also for people who might be listening in the Chicago area, he'll be making an appearance at the Newberry Library on December 18th, 11 o'clock in the morning, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. Mr. Klinger, thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Andy's Hallmark with cards, gift wrap, and candies, and The Reading Group, a nonprofit clinic helping children and youth with reading and writing problems, on the web at thereadinggroup.org. The program also made possible today by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor. That's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. That follows.